You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody.
You're going further and further into rock star territory with your rocker t-shirt and your hipster ponytail.
Well, first of all, I thought pulling my hair back would give me more of a conservative, preppy look, Bill. And I hardly think Tom Petty and Bob Dylan are hard rock at this point. But I will take it as a compliment.
Well, this just shows how edgy. Far off the beam you've fallen, how your never Trumper ways have proven you to be a faux conservative, that you think I have a ponytail now, therefore I'm dressing like a conservative. Seriously, Matt, you just hang it up. Just
you can't see the ponytail. You can't see the ponytail head on. This is like business up front, party in the back. I mean, it's sort might as well be a mullet at this point. I mean, from the view that you have of me, I think this is very appropriate, and I'm not at all edgy or dangerous out there. So,
well, I welcome you to the progressive side of the fence. No matter what you claim, we all know where your heart is.
You know, I don't believe in Beatles. I just believe in me, you know, because of all the changes that have happened in the political world the last few years, Bill, I don't know what I am, but I do know that I continue to piss off progressives with my writing and my tweets. So I can't be of the left.
That's true.
Whatever I am.
You've definitely done a good job trolling progressives about abortion lately. But you're also talking about how Trump is losing his grip on the Republican Party.
Well, there are some data points. Our friend Josh Krausar over at National Journal went through several of them, and I expanded on that in a column for the Daily Beast. And, you know, look, it's never, you know, never write off Trump with the Republican Party and never underestimate their ability to overlook his sins and to suck up to him. However, one thing I'll say, his ability to endorse candidates and have that make a difference is really dubious at this point.
Well, so the two examples that I think are most interesting are what's going on in North Carolina and Alabama. These are both about Senate races. In North Carolina, it's a Senate race that is, you know, a potential pickup opportunity for Democrats. It's maybe a bit of a reach. It's a Republican held seat, but North Carolina has been pretty purple, has a Democratic governor. Biden ran close. Obama won it in 2008. Under the right set of circumstances, Democrats can win there. And so you put up the wrong guy, you put up a guy that's too far flung, you might give away a seat that you otherwise would win. But then Alabama is a state where this should be a lock for Republicans. There's the Doug Jones example, of course, but it's not like you really need to get Alabama right to claim the Senate.
Right.
And yet Trump is putting the same amount of energy into both places and have endorsed candidates who are not the front runner and have not become the front runner after his endorsement.
Yeah.
And even in Alabama, he's not having second thoughts about the person he did pick and is scrambling and reportedly is thinking about switching to somebody else.
Yeah, there's a candidate down there who is a much, you know, sort of charismatic younger woman. And she may end up getting, you know, I think the reporting is that she and her husband look out of central casting, which, you know, is important, you know, to Donald Trump. Which,
it's not running ahead of the parade. It's not like that person is the front runner. He wants to just be seen as being with the winner. Would still be an underdog. Is that correct?
So he endorsed Mo Brooks in Alabama, and Brooks is losing ground to, a candidate named Katie Britt, who was more of a seen as more of like an establishment candidate, but she just had this event. She just had a fundraising event recently in December, it looks like, where Tommy Tuberville and Lindsey Graham attended her fundraiser. So that is interesting, right? These are both candidates that are Trumpy candidates and U.S. senators who are going to her fundraiser. And I think part of it is that Mo Brooks, who's, you know, a congressman from Alabama and a Trumpy sort of guy, just may not be that good and that well-liked. But, you know, she would be, you know, she would obviously have some loyalty to Trump if he endorsed her, but she seems to be just a more put together candidate than Mo Brooks would be.
But Britt is the person Trump's considering endorsing.
That's my understanding.
Okay.
Unless I'm wrong.
So I misunderstood. Because Britt is the person who is the outgoing senator, Richard Shelby's. She was Richard Shelby's chief of staff, right?
I believe that's right. And she's connected to the sort of like the business community, kind of like the Chamber of Commerce.
So she's not truly a hardcore Trump candidate. This would be a case of Trump just sort of getting with the leading establishment candidate to avoid humiliation. Not
that is my understanding. But again, this is one of like five examples, right? So there's Sean Parnell, forced to drop out of the U.S. Senate race in Pennsylvania, who was endorsed by Trump. We mentioned Mo Brooks, endorsed by Trump, who seems to be losing ground. Another example, which is not a primary, but another example of Trump kind of losing his grip, maybe the Bill O'Reilly tour that he's on, which is at least the first event was, I don't want to say sparsely attended, but there were empty seats. There's that Texas special election where Susan Wright was defeated in a race to replace her husband. I think that was in July. And then you've mentioned already North Carolina, where Trump endorsed Ted Budd, who is trailing Governor Pat McCrory in polling.
I just want to emphasize. For North Carolina, yeah. Alabama, in both places, not just did he make these endorsements and the candidate didn't take off, he then has tried to reshuffle who's running in what race. He went to North Carolina and said to this guy, I think Mark Walker, hey, can you drop out of the Senate race and run for the House, and I'll endorse you if you run for the House, and that way it'll be mano a mano, Ted Budd, my guy, versus Pat McCrory, the former governor, and that might make things better for Budd. And hey, in Alabama, I think it's Lynn Blanchard. Hey, Lynn Blanchard, can you drop out of the Senate race and run for governor against Kay Ivey, who I don't like? And that might make it easier for Mo Brooks. Now, probably on top of that, and Blanchard did that. I think Walker hesitated. I think Blanchard followed Trump's lead, but now Trump probably is having second thoughts about Mo Brooks anyway, even after having moved Blanchard out. It just makes... So, I mean, that's a lot of effort. You know, it's a lot of thought.
Yeah.
A lot of Machiavellian machinations that may not even obviously pan out. And I would just think, if I was a rank and file conservative Republican, I would just say to myself, why would I want this guy being the boss of my party? This guy is completely, I mean, you put aside the authoritarianism, put aside, handling of COVID or all that other kind of substantive stuff, just on like, why would you want someone who you just can't trust? You can't take his word. If he endorses you, you don't know if he's going to mean it 2 weeks later. And he's just going to upend he's upending races that have no need to be upended for Republicans to win. It would just drive me batty.
Here's Josh Krausar writing about Alabama. There are some signs that Trump is having second thoughts about supporting Brooks. It's Mo Brooks. After meeting the telegenic Brit and her former football-playing husband before his August rally in the state, Trump came away impressed, according to two Republican sources familiar with the meeting, concluding that the couple came out of political central casting. So, watch out, Mo Brooks. And then, Bill, the other one that we haven't mentioned, because it is not yet an embarrassment, but it may be, is Trump's endorsement and recruitment, apparently, of David Perdue to primary the sitting Republican governor of Georgia, Brian Kemp. I don't think it's not at all clear to me that Perdue will win, and that could prove embarrassing. And then, you know, again, I'm not saying that Trump is done. I'm not saying that he doesn't have a lot of power in the Republican Party, but you would assume that if a guy was sort of omnipotent, you know, that he could impose his will in these primary races. And like, that does not seem to be the case.
I mean, he's definitely not omnipotent. I think the question is, does he still command enough loyalty with the rank and file majority, or even a rank and file plurality, to still be the de facto leader and be able to win a presidential primary? I mean, he didn't win a majority of the votes in the 2016 primary, but still won most of the races. So, you know, we could be overinflating his dominance. These polls say that 2/3 want him to run. It depends what poll you look at. I know Pew was below 50, but most that I've seen have been above 50 as far as wanting him to run and would support him in the field. Most recent one I saw was Harvard Harris, where he was at 67%. Are those soft numbers? I mean, so they could be soft numbers. It could be more like the Pew poll, where he's in the upper 40s within the party. But upper 40s could be enough to still be the nominee. But even if that's the case, if that's as good as he can do as a previously elected president within his own party, that doesn't bode well for winning a general election. It doesn't bode well for having this person be the face of your party. And I would think a more rational Republican would say, look, this is just dead weight, you know, dragging us down here. But this is, he won one fluky race. He got killed in the midterm. He got killed in the 2020 election. We lost the House and the Senate with him in charge. It's not worth it. It's just not worth it for us.
Well, see, and that's the thing about politics is such a, you know, because we only have races every, we only have a presidential race every 4 years. If you get lucky, a few weeks ago, the Washington football team, formerly known as the Redskins, beat Tom Brady and the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, okay? But then they played another game the following week, and then they played another game, and guess what? The Cowboys beat the Redskins a few weeks later. So, like, if you had this fantastical notion that the Washington football team was a good team, you only had to wait a couple weeks until they met Dallas and they returned to form. No, they're not. Guess what? Washington's not a good team. They're not good, okay? But that's because they play every week. We could find that out. But they did have that fluky game. They had they were playing good for a while, and they did beat Tom Brady. And so, like, I think the problem is that, like, Trump, if you look the way you just described it, when you put together his kind of track record, it's not that good. But because he won that 2016 race and the stakes are so high and they only happen every few years, these contests, we attribute to him this brilliance, when in fact, there's a lot of luck involved, and it does not mean he knows what he's doing politically.
Now, this week we had the text sent by various Fox News hosts and Donald Trump Jr. to Trump's then chief of staff, Mark Meadows. He's still considered chief of staff. He still have that title in Trump Inc. I don't know.
Former chief of staff.
But the January 6th commission got a hold of these texts. Mark Meadows coughed. He didn't cough up all of his texts, but he coughed up those. Liz Cheney reads them out loud at a hearing, and this has, you know, dominated the news.
Liz Cheney, who is also being primaried by Donald Trump, we should say.
Right. Although, if I had to guess, I think she was at New Hampshire recently, so I bet she's going to run for president, not, you know, let herself get trampled in Wyoming. Not that she's going to be the president, but I think she'd rather go out, or that she'd rather go big, go home than like just get killed in Wyoming. Anyway.
No. Well, just hang there for 1 second, right. Bill, because I think you're probably right. And I think that's a really interesting way to flip the script and go on offense. Instead of staying in Wyoming and probably getting beaten by Trump, you flip the script and try to like do a suicide mission where you try to basically take out Trump in the presidential race. I think it's probably a good move.
Considering... I wouldn't look at it as a suicide mission. Not that I think she would win, but it's a movement building mission. It's a way to say I'm not going to let this party go down the tubes, and I'm going to begin the process of identifying who are the rational, pro-democracy, uber hawk. You know, she's not a moderate. Liz Cheney is still very conservative, but she's willing to at least play by the basic rules of democracy. Run a campaign, and the people that donate to you, the people that sign up for your email list, the people that show up to your events, like, those are the people. That's your first building block to reclaiming the party over the long haul. So that's my guess of what she's up to here and why she's willing to lean in so hard. I mean, I don't know who got the assignments or who gets to read what text, but I don't think Liz Cheney was sad that she got that assignment. I think she was quite happy to be the person on TV doing this to say, look, I am 100% out of Trump Inc. You know, I mean, you got people who might run for president in the Republican primary, like Chris Christie, who, I mean, Chris Christie's saying, you know, I'm not, essentially, if you can't say you'll run if Trump is in, then you're weak. You know, you got to have enough of your own sense of self and reason of purpose to run regardless of whatever Trump does. But by the same time, I think Trump had a really good presidency and did a lot of great things. And if he's the nominee, then of course I'd support him. Like, you know, Christie can't go all the way out.
Yeah.
And Liz Cheney can go all the way out in a way that almost nobody else can or would.
Well, I think what Cheney's doing is much more admirable than what Christie's doing. I could envision a scenario where if the notion is to slowly, like, to try to erode support from Trump, both of those, having them both with these different messages could do it. You know, you've got Cheney kind of standing up to him and taking him on for being a bad guy who is hurting democracy. But then you've got Christie making a more subtle argument where it's just like, I like Trump, but he's the past. I like Trump, but he can't win in the future. I like Trump, but he's costing us suburban voters and he's unelectable. I like Trump, but it's time to move on to the next thing. That actually may be, if you are a Republican, a more persuasive and seductive argument. And I think that if you were to combine Cheney's argument with Christie's, maybe there's sort of combined, they can start to erode. So in a way, I think it's helpful that they have different messages.
Wait, can we get back to the text?
Yeah.
Does it have any reverberation within the Republican Party, within the conservative movement, that Laura Ingraham, Sean Hannity, Don Trump Jr., Brian Kilmeade were saying things in private that they weren't saying in public?
You know, you got to quit coming to me as if I'm the right wing whisperer, because I have no idea. I don't even know if they know it. Like, seriously, I mean, you and I we couldn't avoid these texts. I mean, the video of Cheney reading them was all over Twitter. But if you're the average Trump person, Trump supporter who isn't really on Twitter, or at least not that much, or if you are, you're following Seb Gorka or something. And you're watching Fox News, you're listening to Bongino. I listened to Bongino yesterday. The whole thing was going against, you know, Liz Cheney. I'm not sure he ever said why he's mad at her, though. Like, I'm not sure that they're even aware of these texts.
Well, I saw a little bit of I wasn't watching live. I saw some clips of Tucker on Twitter where he basically was trying to give a a shrug of the shoulders. You know, they said the same thing in private as they did in public. You know, they wanted this to stop and asked Trump to stop it. And Trump did. Trump did say, yeah, this should happen, which, of course, I think omits a whole bunch of things. But they seem to be trying to, you know, twist it and spin it away to make it seem like these were more innocuous and not off message, not departure from Trump. But it just seems like a pretty plain reading. This is, you know, Donald Trump, you know, this has gotten out of hand. This shit needs to stop. Laura Ingraham saying this is ruining, you know, the legacy. You know, there's a different edge to those texts than what they were saying, you know, on air. I mean, obviously, if you're the super diehard Trumper, you're going to believe the spin. But is there an element of the soft Trump, the middle of the Republican Party, perhaps? Is this one extra data point to say, you know what, the guy did some good things, but yeah, I just can't keep going with this.
That's totally possible, Bill. I think I talked last week about, you know, the tipping point, right? And you chop down a tree, it may take 100 whacks of the axe before it falls. And like, which hit was it? Was it the first, you know, the first chop, or the 50th, or the 100th? I mean, sometimes you take a swing and seemingly nothing happens. And so, yeah, it's hard to quantify the impact, the cumulative impact every time this sort of thing, happens. I definitely think it is possible that you could have people. And by the way, I think that this sort of revelation could help the Chris Christie argument, right? The Chris Christie argument, which is basically like, I like Trump. Trump did a lot of good things, but it's time to move on. He created a lot of chaos, a lot of drama, and he's toxic, you know? I think that this would help the Chris Christie argument, actually. So yes, I think that this could make a difference. It will not be immediately recognized or apparent, but now I will say this, though, speaking of the people who sent the texts, I think that there's a big difference between, it seems like the members of Congress who were sending the texts were actually concerned about their personal safety, you know, call off the mob because they've breached the Capitol. Whereas the Fox News hosts and contributors who were texting Mark Meadows, their prime concerns seemed to be optics. Like, it wasn't like Trump needs to do this. He needs to stop this because it's the right thing, or he needs to stop this because someone could get hurt, or he needs to stop this because democracy is too important. It was like, he needs to stop this because it's going to undermine all the good work Donald Trump has done. Mm-hmm. Now, they could be saying that because they know that's the only way to get Trump to do anything. Mm-hmm. But I think it was revelatory, and that's what their prime goal was. They were concerned that this was going to hurt Trumpism and hurt his legacy and their legacy by extension. And that's not exactly the most noble reason to try to call off the riot.
Let me shift gears to what's going on with Democrats in Congress. We're back in Manchinology mode. There was maybe some thought after the infrastructure bill passed that Democrats were really close on Build Back Better. It did pass the House soon after, and then we just have to, you know, cross a couple T's and dot a couple I's, and boom, we'll be done here. But Manch has clearly, you know, hit the brakes on it, and we're still in a guessing game whether he wants to get to yes or not. And so at this juncture, we're talking on Wednesday the 15th. It seems, you know, physically impossible for the Senate to pass this before Christmas. We were in the end of the year. And maybe not completely impossible for Manchin and Schumer and Biden to have an informal deal by Christmas, but there's nothing coming out of Manchin to make you very hopeful for that. He's still sounding kind of pessimistic notes and worrying about inflation and budget gimmickry and those kinds of talking points. But Manchin also keeps saying, well, I need to see the final text. I need to see what the parliamentarian says. I need to see the final CBO score, which is sort of this oddly passive stance because he could be writing it in a way to make it easier to pass parliamentarian muster and get a good CBO score. And he's kind of like, yeah, show it, see what they do and show me what you got after that. And I'll tell you what I think. You know, he puts himself in the position of being the 50th vote and then doesn't do things that a 50th vote should do. Which he just raises the question whether he wants to be, you know, number 50 or, you know, number 49. Actually, it'd be 50 either way because Kamala would be 51 and then a tie.
I had lunch with mom yesterday and we went to a different restaurant than we normally go to. We went to a restaurant I used to work at when it was a different restaurant, and now it's a Mexican restaurant, and we had lunch there.
This is in Maryland?
This is in Frederick, Maryland.
Okay.
And I made the mistake of wearing, I got one of those, you know, they gave me for Christmas last year, maybe. They sent me like a CNN shirt, and it said like America needs journalists, you know? And I made the mistake of wearing that. But I made the mistake of wearing that out to lunch, but not in the way you think. I was an older couple on the way in. The guy was like, "You're right about that," you know, and I was like, "If someone's telling me this, they're probably liberals. They're probably progressives."
Yeah.
So then, on his way out, the couple stopped and talked to me and asked me like if I'm a journalist and thank me for my service to the country as a journalist. And I told him where I worked and they assumed that I was, you know, a progressive. And I don't want to get into a political discussion, but the guy, one of the things the guy said was about how, like, and I hear this a lot from people, like how mad they are at Joe Manchin. Now this guy lives in Maryland, but I hear it from West Virginians too, that I bump into who think that I'm of the left. Mm-hmm. That, you know,
well, you're wearing a ponytail, Matt. So we all know what team you're really on.
Well, I wasn't wearing a ponytail then, but I had like, you know, my hair it's gotten long. I was wearing with the long hair and the shirt that said America needs journalists. I may have been code switching, or whatever the term is. So anyway, you know, and I've gotten pretty good at this where he was like, Joe Manchin's really been a disappointment. And I'd be like, uh-huh. You know, it's just like I'm not agreeing or disagreeing. I'm like, he's definitely making a name for himself, you know, that kind of thing. Because I don't want to get into a conversation. But in any event, there are people out there in and near West Virginia who are unhappy with his performance.
I think this is a total digression. I think what you should do, Matt, is you should take a month, drive across the country, go to like all, you should do a reverse New York Times. You should go to all blue cities and you should have like a week's worth of tie-dye t-shirts and then go to coffee houses and strike up political conversations and learn what the liberals are really like. What do they really say when no one's looking?
Then I can go to one of the meetings and so you're saying that I should be like a narc. I should like narc on the left.
It might open your eyes that there's all this warmth and love and community that you never noticed before. I don't know how it's going to turn out.
Well, you know, Hitler did. I think Hitler started off as a double agent like that. So I want to be careful I don't get sucked in. Not to compare the left to that.
Is that how liberal fascism starts? You see Hitler in the cafes.
And you know what the great move would be like, where someone's like, "You're not a real leftist, man. You're a narc." And then they try to like pull the wig off and it's real hair. And that's when they're convinced that I am legit. Like I'm the real deal because I tried to pull his hair and it didn't come off, man. He's one of us.
But you were saying you went to talk to mom about what's going on in the Senate. And what did mom have to say?
No. I didn't. We didn't get to politics. It was I wanted to tell the story about.
Okay.
I made the mistake of wearing that. I should never wear anything that reveals anything to do with journalism or politics. But I wore that shirt. It's a hoodie. It was a nice day yesterday, and it says like America needs journalists, and that got me spotted, and that got me in this situation where this guy's just railing on how horrible Joe Manchin is.
Well, yeah, and I just well, get back to that like, point.
Yeah, I mean, there's something.
There's massive frustration with Joe Manchin amongst Democrats. I wrote a piece myself.
I picked up on that yesterday.
I mean, I wrote a piece for the Monthly. You know, I've been an annoying defender of the moderates this whole year, but my argument to Manchin is, look, you won. All your annoying hemming and hawing and your word salad and your nonsensical arguments and Kyrsten Sinema's inscrutability, like, it's all worked out for you. You know, everything's coming up Manchin. You got the infrastructure bill you wanted. You've pocketed all these concessions on Build Back Better. That thing's half the size that it used to be. And it's abundantly clear that you have all the leverage and progressives have none of the leverage. So congratulations. So just tell us the bill you want and let's pass that bill. If this is not to your liking what the House did, then go change it. I mean, however you change it, Joe Manchin, I guarantee you Democrats are going to accept. They are so thirsty. They are so desperate. I can't know if his game plan is to kill it or to pass something. If it is to pass something, if he thinks, you know what, I don't even know if I can do 1.5. I think it's got to be 1 trillion. I think I got to drop these things that have, you know, 3-year, 4-year time frames because it's going to be a budget gimmick. And I got to have us do like just 3 or 4 long-term things and that's it. Whatever it is, if he says that, progressives are going to be like, all right, whatever, that's the best we're going to do. Like, he has that power right now, and I don't see the logic. He isn't getting more power dragging it out. Like, he's at maximum leverage as it is. So I don't
there
know
is
what
anger,
the game
though.
Plan is for him. If he wants to kill it, like, kill it now. Like, what are you waiting for? If you want to say, look, I just can't do it. It's a bad bill, and I can't do it. Then just say that. I mean, the worst thing for Democrats broadly is to have this, you know, going to March or April, and, you know, they can't do anything else because they're stuck on this. And they look like complete Keystone Cops heading into the midterms. And with no, I mean, obviously getting this passed is plan A, but if Manchin killed it today, they at least have, you know, a month more with a plan B, and they got something else to try to push for in the new year. The more you drag us out, they can't even do that. And who gets hurt if Democrats, I mean, you know, they might lose the Congress no matter what happens because of the pendulum swing, but there's a difference between losing 10 seats and losing 70 seats. And if it's a total blowout, who gets killed the most? The moderates in the swing seats that Manchin wants to keep around. So I don't see why it helps him to
there's definitely
the
frustration
biggest
this summer
possible in this process.
This summer I ran into a guy who used to be my guitar teacher like 20 some years ago, and I ran into him in Shepherdstown, West Virginia, and you know, we were kind of reconnected, and he's I told him about what I'm doing, and he's now like he like teaches like literature in Virginia, so he commutes on a motorcycle. Still a cool guy. Every day back and forth. And he told me this was this summer. He says, like, every day on the way to work, must be noisy on a motorcycle. He says, every day on the way to work, I call Manchin's district office and curse them out. And every day on the way home, I call his office and curse him out every single day.
This is a West Virginia resident?
Yes.
I mean, obviously,
there is anger out there directed at Joe Manchin.
I mean, it's a pretty Trumpy state, and I would imagine that person is not the majority of West Virginia. But I'm curious if there, I mean, it only takes, you know, a few hundred people to give the impression of an onslaught of phone calls. And if his phone is
ringing he lives more... in, this guy lives in Shepherdstown, West Virginia, which is like Mayberry meets Haight Ashbury.
I mean, it's the like, blue dots.
It's a very liberal small town. And it's a college town.
But the more that he hears, I mean, he claims to be, I'm just doing what's right for West Virginia. I work for people of West Virginia. And, you know, he's indicating that he goes to the grocery store. These people concerned about inflation, concerned about this bill. But the more and more he's hearing from the Democratic side of the fence within his state, that has to have some kind of impression, I would think. And I just think, and the things he's complaining about, he can fix. These are not insurmountable challenges. He can rejigger when the tax revenue happens and front load more of it, so it balances. It's a balanced budget. It's that doesn't add to the deficit in the early years. He could say, you know what, child tax credit, it can't go for 1 year and out. It has to be, it's got to be 0 years. You keep it refundable, but at a lower level. Or he could even say, look, Biden, I need you to make a public statement that you're not going to ask for an extension 1 year from now. And let's face it, you're probably going to lose the House and or the Senate, and you probably can't get that extension anyway. So just make it clear. And when you do that, I'll say, look, I know this is not going to be a budget gimmick. It's not a Trojan horse, and that'll make me comfortable. Like, there's things he could try or insist upon that he isn't, at least not offering it publicly. Maybe he's offering it privately. Publicly, he acts as if like it's all out of his hands, which is ridiculous. He has all the power here.
All right, so Bill, we are doing a we're going to try to do one more of these this year, right?
Yes,
next week before
Christmas on Wednesday, and I think we should be able to DM Zoom this Friday. But then we got to take a bit of a break. Got to take a holiday break.
That's right, man. So you know, check us if you want to be part of the DM Zoom. You can go to patreon.com/billshare and patreon.com/mattlewis. You can join our community and you will be invited to these Zoom calls that we do every so often. And follow us on Twitter at DMZ Show. Bill, anything you need to plug?
I already mentioned that Manchin piece. I think that's all I got for right now.
Awesome. All right. Well, we'll see you guys back in the DMZ for one last 2021 episode next week. Until then.
Take care.